It's time for Sounding Off with Phil Goff.
Morena, your worship. How are you this morning?
Morena, very good, thanks, Sarah. And I hope Rachel's feeling a bit better soon.
I hope so too, although she did the right thing, especially in the city's yeah. current climate. She went straight to the doctor and got it tested in, apparently.
Yeah,
strep throat.
My strongest advice to anybody with a cough or a sneeze, you're not likely to have coronavirus, but the person sitting next to you won't know that.
Exactly.
So stay at home. And it's actually not bad advice as we approach the winter season of flu to do the same. I mean, one of the remarkable things, you know, people are naturally feel anxiety about coronavirus, but the common flu each year kills 650,000 people across the world, including over 500 in New Zealand. And we're kind of pretty blasé about the flu. And maybe the wake-up call of coronavirus is, coronavirus isn't going to have near that impact of the common flu in New Zealand. But we just need to think about the sensible precautions that each of us should take to avoid spreading any sort of cold or flu in the community. You know, things like washing your hands more frequently, about, you know, not sneezing on your hand and then shaking hands with people. There's a lot of really sound messages that are coming out now about coronavirus that we should actually apply through the winter season for the flu as well.
Totally. Just good hygiene practice, basically.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's little things that I actually even hadn't thought of. When you cough or sneeze, don't sneeze into your hand, sneeze into your elbow, because you're not shaking hands with anybody with your elbow, but you may be with your hand. So, it's common sense. Washing your hands for 20 seconds, and then making it with soap. You don't have to have an alcohol-based substance, but then drying your hands thoroughly as well. You know, they're little things, but it's worth reminding everybody that this is the sort of etiquette we should be following.
Totally. And with regards to reminding the people of Auckland best practice, do you think, because we've asked the Prime Minister the same question as well, do you think there is enough information out there for the public about coronavirus? Because obviously sometimes when there's a lack of information, misinformation fills that vacuum, and with it comes its horrible bedfellow xenophobia even. So do you think there's enough out there for people to feel that they know about what's happening?
Well, there's certainly a lot out there, but that doesn't mean to say, because you and I might be aware of that everybody is aware of it.
Right.
I just heard a brilliant interview over the weekend with Kim Hill with a guy called Chris Smith, who's a virologist at Cambridge University. And, you know, if you wanted to know everything about coronavirus, you would have got it out of that 40 minutes. Dr. Susie Wiles has been in the paper. She's wonderful, Susie. And Dr. Michael Baker, they're all saying the same thing. And the Prime Minister and I and other people around the country are strictly following the evidence-based advice that we're getting from health officials. And, you know, what worries me is when you get somebody like Brian Tamaki saying, as long as you're a tithe-paying religious believer, you know, that will protect you. That sort of stuff is just so much nonsense. I mean, you know, it just defies imagination. But what the Director General of the World Health Organization said, I think, was worth repeating. The greatest enemy now is fear, rumor, and stigma.
Yeah.
And facts, reason, and solidarity are our greatest asset. So to go back to your original point, yeah, we've just got to keep hammering those messages. Don't panic. You know, as soon as people see other people rushing down to the supermarket to clear the shelves, they think, oh my God, it must be worse. As soon as people read the front page of the Herald and the blazing headline, pandemonium. Yeah, and then a picture of a train in Iran that doesn't say it's a train in Iran being cleaned by a man in a uniform. Oh, that is so irresponsible.
It was quite bad, yes.
Yeah, look, let's avoid the panic, but let's take sensible precautions. We know that coronavirus is more contagious than the flu. We know it has a higher mortality rate. But at the same time, it probably won't, almost certainly won't have the impact that the common flu does. But let's do the things we can to protect ourselves against people coming into the country with it, and the government's taken quite extraordinary steps in that regard. Let's make sure that and the hospitals are set up with reverse pressure chambers to deal with it. self-isolation, we've got 8,000 people in self-isolation. Now, you couldn't fit 8,000 people into a hospital, and they don't need to be in a hospital, but they are at risk, and self-isolation means that we lower the chance of it spreading, which is the main focus of the campaign now.
So you're happy that Auckland is prepared in terms of pandemic response plans, things like that? Like, you've had them on file for a while, and should the worst happen, we have the resources to deal with it?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we're a first world country with a first world health system and a first world city, and that means that the sort of problems that you've seen in Hubei and that you're seeing in Iran at the moment aren't likely to be replicated in New Zealand. We've managed to hold off it reaching New Zealand for a very long time. The health department has been putting the plans in place. They have plans for, you know, I think it will reach a pandemic status internationally. The best advice that we have from health authorities is that while they knew inevitably it would come to New Zealand, they believe that it's there's a low likelihood of a major spread of the disease. But to make sure that there is that low likelihood, we need to put into practice what people are advising us to do. Just one other little piece of advice. If you don't have a cold or the flu, wearing a mask isn't going to help you much. So don't go down and pay $50 because somebody's ripping you off because there's a shortage of face masks. But if you do have a cold or the flu, yes, wear a face mask. That's not a bad habit. The Japanese have been doing it for a long, long time because that helps stop you spreading the germs that you might have, whether they be cold germs or flu germs or even potentially coronavirus, but not likely coronavirus.
All right, some good points covered there, particularly with regards to information and where you're getting it from.
Yeah. Don't listen to Brian Tamaki on this or anything else for that matter.
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea he was saying that. That's so dangerous and so depressing.
It's crazy stuff, and it's self-serving, and I just deplore it.
Well, that's another thing. If somebody's charging you $50 for a face mask as well, ask yourself, who's benefiting from this? Speaking of information and education, there's been some not greatly hopeful reports on the amount of people voting in elections for Auckland Council. Did these disappoint you a lot? Like, were 2 out of 3 eligible voters just simply didn't even vote?
It is disappointing, and sadly, it's not even just an Auckland problem. It's a problem that goes right across New Zealand and local government. It's central government. There's a lot more hoopla around it, a lot more information around the candidates. There's political affiliation. So if you don't know the candidate,
you
probably
know
do know something about the party and the policies. There's a lot more media attention. Our voting was at the last election in Auckland, I think 35.3%, which means that just under two-thirds of people who were eligible to vote didn't. And we've done a study, you know, as you'd expect, through our research people, who aren't voting. Young people, if you're between 26 and 30, your voting rate's 20%. If you're between 76 and 80, it's 61%, 3 times higher.
Yeah.
If you're Maori, your voting rate is 25%, as against non-Maori, 36%. But the biggest indicator of voting likelihood is socioeconomic deprivation. And what it shows is that the areas that are the poorest are the areas where there is the lowest turnout. And maybe that is a correlation with people have got other more pressing problems on their mind.
Totally.
They're not thinking about voting much. They may be less well informed about how much it matters. But what are the reasons for non-voting? I mean, for me, there are two that jump out. One is that people say to me, we've got too little information about the candidates. And one of the interesting things we found in our research, that 25% of those who started filling out their ballot paper didn't get to the end of it. And there's a thing called the District Health Board. Now, there is nobody that I have talked to right across the board that says they knew who the candidates were, or they knew who what the elected members actually did. And then they've got the situation where that's a different voting system, STV, Standard Transferable Vote, where you've got a number in order of preference, the candidates, as against a tick on the box for first past the post. So we we make it unnecessarily complex, and there's a question that has to be asked about, you know, whether you should have so many different bodies being voted for in the local body election, because that's obviously a turn-off for people. But we need to get more information out there about candidates. We probably need to stress the relevance of voting. You know, people sometimes don't have a really good idea of what local government does.
Totally, and particularly, you know, with regards to district health boards as well. Like, some of those decisions can be absolutely important to your well-being within your ward or your council. With regards to us talking about socioeconomic reasons for not voting, the chair of the Otara Papatoetoe board said that there was a lot of feedback that if we were able to vote online in the local council elections, that would make life easier. Are there reasons why it has to be done by post?
The main reason that we haven't yet adopted online voting is twofold. One, it's the cost of setting it up. And the second thing is the worry about getting it wrong and creating chaos, and the Government Communications Security Bureau saying these systems are very vulnerable to being hacked.
Right.
Now, I'm not quite sure that people in the Kremlin or Beijing or anywhere else in the world are particularly interested in influencing the outcome of the Auckland Council elections or the hospital board elections, but there are some genuine worries there. Should we move to online voting? That should be an option, absolutely, and it will have to become more of an option as our postal services gradually decline and fade away. But I think you've got to have a multimodal system. You've got to make it possible for people to vote, you know, using the physical papers that are delivered to you, with the alternative of online voting, and probably the alternative on the day before election and election day of having at least one polling place opened in each ward of the council. Mm. You know, all of those things would help. But online voting by itself, when we've looked at Canada, and the multiple places where they've introduced it there, it may be increased the voting turnout by 2-3%, but not much more than that. So it's a factor, but it's not a factor that's sufficient on its own to turn around and get more people involved. I'd really like to see, you know, one of the sad things is that, you know, with the decline of our community newspapers, that used to be where local councillors, local board members could get some profile about what they were doing in their community, and that's become less and less as time goes on. So that's a problem. Lack of information in schools. Schools don't spend a lot of time saying, hey, you live in a democracy. That gives you important rights and it also gives you responsibilities. I think we could look at what more could be done at the school end of it to give young people an awareness of what the voting process is about and why it's significant for you to use that right to cast your vote and what the issues might be. So no silver bullet solution, but a multitude of things that we could probably do better.
Well, I'm massively biased because I work at a regional radio station. Well, I'm a big believer in regional media, so you've said the right things to me. Also, it must be slightly hopeful that when there were things in the election, such as one-stop shops where people could turn up, enroll and vote, that they were almost overwhelmed. So there was the drive for people to come and do it when they were given options such as this. Maybe just boost those up next time around.
No. I agree entirely with you there, Sarah. It's, you know, we should be putting the polling booths outside the supermarkets.
Right.
We should be turning up on a Sunday outside the Pacifica churches and saying to people, hey, have you cast your vote yet? If not, you can do it here. Let's make it as easy as possible. That's one aspect of getting the turnout up. But there is also that real question. And look, I've looked at I got the booklet through the mail of the 150-word statements. 150 words is so small that you find that almost every candidate is saying pretty much the same thing. So it doesn't always help you out. So I just think we've got to work laterally. I've asked our research people to focus more on it. I've asked them to work with people in Auckland University of Technology, talk to other local governments around the country, look at best practice around the world, and try to try to get the best system we can possibly put in place and try to overcome that that absence of information. You know, and one of the sad things about local government politics is if something goes wrong, it'll be a front page headline, but if something goes really well, it doesn't exist. So people think, oh, the only thing that happens at local government is things go wrong. Absolutely not. You know, we're in the process of, you know, transforming, turning around our city with huge infrastructure projects. I know they cause disruption, but they're about building the future, and we just need more attention, and that means the politicians working more closely with the media and the community as well. I think that's important.
All right, wonderful. We've covered so many great things today. Thank you very much, Your Worship. We will talk to you same time next week.
Always a pleasure. Okay, thanks, Sarah.
Bye.
That was Sounding Off with Phil Goff.